Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com and by audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken word entertainment. Get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting today for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From the windy city of Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On this week's show, our end-of-the-year blowout continues with our top five male and female lead performances of the year.
Plus, Massacre Theater music from Exit Clove and Adam's conversation with Ellen Page and Diablo Cody, the star and screenwriter of the new comedy, Juno.
We'll also have a review of Juno, but first, Will Smith is legend.
Nothing happened the way it was supposed to happen. 6 billion people on Earth when the infection hit. I'm a survivor living in New York City. I will be at the South Street Seaport every day at midday when the sun is highest in the sky.
I Am Legend is the third film adaptation of Richard Matheson's 1954 classic sci-fi novel of the same name, the fourth if you count November's straight-to-video release I Am Omega, starring Mark Dacascos. Matty, top five Mark Dacascos roles, go.
The Pillow Book? Was he in The Pillow Book?
He wasn't. He was on CSI for a spell, though. Well, I Am Legend's star is a little more recognizable. Set in the near future, 2012, Will Smith plays Army scientist Robert Neville, possibly the last man on Earth and, at the very least, the last man in New York City who hasn't been turned into a nocturnal, flesh-eating zombie. Neville is working on a cure to save those who were infected by the man-made virus that wiped out humanity, including his wife and child. Now, Matty, I mentioned the previous incarnations of I Am Legend because it made me think of another sci-fi pseudo-zombie movie from earlier this year, The Invasion, itself the third big-screen version of 1956's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I know you didn't see The Invasion, fortunately for you, but trust me, the filmmakers labored to be topical with several references to the U.S. occupation of Iraq, among other notable world conflicts. Did you see any similar attempts to be profound here, or does director Francis Lawrence deliver the kind of good old-fashioned entertainment we expect from a big-budget Will Smith spectacle, say on a hot day in July?
Yeah, I think this movie really works as an action film. It's a solid 3-star action movie, and I can recommend it as a good time. It plays out like a really good Twilight Zone episode at its best. And I think when it really works, what really worked for me was the sight of New York gone to seed, you know, like an unmowed lawn. That's my favorite part. It's brilliantly realized, and every time Will Smith runs into a landmark, you know, in ruins like Grand Central Station, it plays really believably. And Will Smith is a lot of fun, and he's already proven that he can carry a film. And there's a little bit of an edge to this performance, and I like that, a little bit of a darker side. All that said, what doesn't work was what you were speaking to. It's when this film attempts to be profound, and that comes up a lot. Smith isn't given the language to show us the strain his isolation is taking on him. You know, they try really hard. None of it really rings true. Say what you will about something like Castaway, but Tom Hanks and Wilson the volleyball cover the same ground much more effectively. I never really felt Smith was in danger of, I don't know, psychological disintegration. And every time they tried to show that, it never really rung true.
Well, we might as well have been sharing a brain while watching this film, because literally I saw it the exact same way. Of course, I had to make a note of the Wilson Castaway theme here. It's a nice thing they do where, of course, you've got the last man on Earth. We have to give him something to do, to give him something to feed off of so the audience can care about him. They give Tom Hanks a volleyball. Here Will Smith gets his dog. It works. Without him, it would have been pretty dreadful to watch. And the film does work early on. The first half to two-thirds of this movie is really well made, and I actually do recommend it as well. I think Lawrence, the director, Francis Lawrence, has a really nice mix of handheld shots and close-ups that make it really urgent and create a lot of tension without going all Paul Greengrass on us. And I do think that there are a lot of good thrills here. I mean, there are a few legit jump out of your seat moments.
Oh, it made me jump out of my seat 9 times.
Yeah, me too. I don't know about 9, but close. And I know there were many more that made me feel really uncomfortable. I mean, there's the scene where Smith's dog, Sam, takes off into a dark building and doesn't come out. And that entire sequence is pretty intense. I also loved that they don't give us too much backstory. We see Smith's former life only in flashbacks, only in dreams. I actually thought maybe they gave us a little more than we needed to know, but we get just enough information about what happened to the world to satisfy us without forcing a bunch of scientific mumbo-jumbo down our throats, which I thought was going to happen. We find a cure for cancer in the first scene of the film. 3 years later, humanity is wiped out. I'll play along with that, and yeah. I did play along with it. But you're right, where it goes wrong is in these moments where it tries to go a little bit abstract and profound and have Will Smith disintegrating psychologically. I mostly just felt really sorry for him in those
scenes.
Yeah,
it's not his fault that it doesn't work. It's just a matter of trying to force the issue with these conceits. There's that scene with the Shrek movie.
Yes.
Basically, and there's... they try and do the Wilson volleyball thing through mannequins. Basically,
right.
that's their way of getting around that. But the other big problem for me was the vampires.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I can call this movie Attack of the Beowulf People because that's what they look like.
Yeah.
They're computer-generated vampires. They look like uncooked Johnsonville brats.
That's true.
Okay? And just fake to the nth degree. And I know I sound like a jaded 50-year-old tab-swizzling K-Pro user, but I'm just tired of CGI characters. Yeah, they made me jump, but the movie didn't become about Will Smith versus the vampires. It became about when are those computer-generated demons going to come at me next. Basically, that's all it was. Please, just put somebody in makeup. There's no substitute for a living, breathing thing, no matter how bad the makeup job is. If you put a computer-generated vampire next to a real live person, I am going to lose interest because all I'm going to be thinking about is how fake they look.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That element is there, and that doesn't work. And I think about a movie that I, of course, like from earlier this year, like 28 Weeks Later, where you have these crazed zombies running around. That is much more effective when you see real people.
Yeah.
In that state than seeing these CGI creatures. You're absolutely right. I don't think they are as scary at all. And it's really funny that you made the mannequin reference because that was the other scene, the first scene where we see Will Smith kind of losing it a little bit mm-hmm. after this tremendous moment of grief happens. He goes and talks to this mannequin like he's hitting on her, and it's just bad.
Yeah.
And not good bad. I know it's trying to be awkward and show his kind of sense of alienation and how he doesn't know how to communicate with anyone anymore, but it just really doesn't work. And I have to say, too, despite everything that works about this film, the last 20 or 30 minutes just goes way too fast. It's way too rushed.
Really rushed.
And really resolves in a way that feels way too nice and tidy. And I just didn't believe where the film was going after it took all this great care in setting up this environment and New York City as this wasteland and Will Smith as his last man in his routine. That's all great. And then it has to rush to a conclusion. I just didn't buy it.
What's the prognosis, Fertile Myrtle? Minus or plus?
There it is. Little pink plus sign is so unholy.
That ain't no Etch-a-Sketch. This is one doodle that can't be undid, Holmes Gillett.
Just tell him. I'm pregnant.
Who is the father?
It's Polly Bleeker.
Polly Bleeker.
Maddie, we move on now to a quick discussion of the movie Juno. And the only reason we're not giving this film a complete segment here to talk about is because we actually did discuss it in some detail during our dispatches and our big Toronto Top 5 show. Anyone who heard those shows already knows that we love this film. It was your number one film that we saw in Toronto. It was my number two film next to No Country for Old Men. And this really is kind of becoming this indie darling. A lot of critics are getting behind it. Audiences in Toronto absolutely raved about it. But there are a few exceptions, and I want to cite this email we just got from one of our listeners, Nick Palmer, in Los Angeles, California, who I actually met during a trip out to San Francisco. Good guy, Nick, as jaded and wrong as he is here. He writes about Juno. The characters are so carefully kept at a distance, they're all given quirks. They're dressed in costumes rather than clothing, either put in full-on uniforms like Michael Cera's head and wristbands. If you can get past the costumes, the dialogue made any emotion impenetrable. It's just so clever and proud of itself. The few performances that managed to work, J.K. Simmons, Allison Janney, and Michael Cera, felt like the actors were fighting for air, attempting to have even small moments of sincerity in the sea of ironic distance. Because the filmmaker is so terrified of letting his character show any real emotion, Nick writes, throughout the film, when he finally needs an emotional climax, he has to resort to artificially creating it out of running the camera in slow motion and playing a pretty song a la Wes Anderson. So Nick, obviously, tired of all the irony, tired of the Wes Andersonization of independent films here. We know you like the film. Tell Nick why he's wrong.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Nick, but we here at Film Spotting have been on guard against quirk for about 3 months now, ever since Darjeeling Limited came out. And let me tell you, I think most indie filmmakers should take note of the success of this film and realize You can't just throw a bunch of quirky characters into a situation and slap a Shins soundtrack on it. You have to have heart, and this movie does have heart in spades. And I was worried because the first scene does just sort of drip with indie irony and quirk. And you have Ellen Page going to the 7-Eleven, toting around a Sunny Delight, engaging in a rapid, pithy conversation with a clerk played by Rainn Wilson. And the dialogue really comes across as sort of indie precious, sort of Kevin Smith, Whit Stillman light. And I was nervous. But then throughout the film, Diablo Cody's script completely flips your expectations on end. And I love how complete the characters are. They're not just quirky at all. And by complete, I mean human. Yes, Juno is a strong woman, but she's also 17, and she thinks she knows more than she actually does. She thinks she's more mature than she actually is. She's fallible. Mm-hmm. Now, counter that with Jason Bateman's character. Now, at first, we really appreciate his inner child. We want him to focus on his music rather than slave away at his ad jingle job. We sympathize with his situation because he's married to Jen Garner's character, who, in contrast to Bateman, is much more driven, much more ready to embrace not only parenthood, but the responsibilities of adulthood. And in those early scenes, Garner comes across as sort of this stick in the mud. But as this movie goes along, we really start to side with her. We want Bateman to grow up.
Yeah.
We want him to start to embrace responsibilities, and your allegiances shift.
Yeah. This is an amazing film, and we really haven't talked about the plot at all in case you didn't gather it from anything you may have read or from the trailer we played a clip from a moment ago. It's pretty simple. Juno is a teenager who one day gets bored, decides to have sex with her sort of boyfriend. Right. For the first time, played by Michael Cera, and she ends up getting pregnant, and she decides to keep the baby rather than have an abortion, puts it up for adoption. Jason Bateman and Jennifer Garner are the couple, the perfectly seeming couple in the suburbs who are going to come and adopt the baby. That's the basic premise of this film. And where Nick is really wrong, and you touched on this about how we've kind of been on alert for too much quirk since the Darjeeling Limited, yes, there are certain Wes Anderson elements here, but the difference is, and as much as I like some of Wes Anderson's abilities as a filmmaker, he hasn't had any real characters since maybe Bottle Rocket, and even that could be arguable. But since Bottle Rocket, I don't know that you've seen anybody who isn't just a mass of quirk. Here, these characters all start out that way, but they all evolve into real people. And just as we start to get a beat on who we think all these people are, we think that Juno is more mature and smarter than she is, but she really is vulnerable. And that's what's great about her, and that she's so detached from it all. No, she really isn't so detached. And the parents, who we write off as kind of the blue-collar plumber, and the mom who is into her dogs and isn't going to get anything about being a teenager nowadays, she absolutely gets it. And even Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman, what's hilarious about the way they evolve as characters is when we first see him, Juno goes to their house and she goes to the bathroom and she's looking at the pictures on the wall, and it cuts to a picture of them, a professional studio portrait that looks like something out of a Christopher Guest film. Like, the pose is just ridiculous. And I'm like, wow, this movie's really going to paint these people as just these dumb yuppies, and we're going to mock them the whole time, like we see in a lot of Wes Anderson inspired films. It doesn't go down that path. As soon as we think that's going to happen, the movie turns those people into flesh and blood characters.
Exactly. You are going to be continually surprised by this movie, just as Juno is continually surprised by those closest around her. That's what I love. It's kind of the education of Juno. Juno is this too cool for school character, thinks she's smarter than most everybody, has a flippant answer ready for anybody. She's sort of like a walking onion headline, you know, who gets, throughout this film, injected with humanity. And you talked about Alice and Janney. Juno first introduces her as someone who loves dogs. I don't know if it's like Vishlas or Weimaraners. And we see her quickly, you know, cutting out a picture from a magazine. Now, a regular independent film would just leave it at that. A character with all quirk. But Diablo Cody, writing from her own experience as a stepmom, infuses what could be a stereotypical Minnesota mom complete with embroidered loon sweatshirt with great humor and surprising wisdom. And the highlight is this sonogram scene where the stepmom really gets to shine. And the lesson is, don't be smug, don't judge. And that's a lesson for all independent filmmakers out there right now.
Yeah, absolutely. This film, like I said in Toronto, and you touched on it, the first 10 minutes don't really work. You've got the master of quirk, Rainn Wilson, and you're setting up this scene. It's in the trailer, and Nick even mentioned it, where he says something like, that's one doodle that can't be undone, Holmes Skillet. You hear something like that, and you're like, oh my God, this is going to be cloying. This is going to be 90 minutes of that kind of dialogue, trying to be too cool for school, and I'm not going to be able to take it. But after the first 10 or 15 minutes, that wears off. It becomes totally natural. All of the characters, the actors deliver those lines perfectly, mm-hmm. and it works. And there is emotion. When the movie needs to be emotional, I don't know what Nick is talking about. When it needs that emotional kick at the end, I was surprised at how moved I really was when it got to the end of this film, for a film that made me laugh so hard to then move me the way it did. That's a great movie.
Exactly. And I think it owes its success to Ellen Page. Mm-hmm. She really grounds us. Her facility with that material is brilliant, and it keeps it from being an affected enterprise.
Absolutely. I think we may hear more about Ms. Page later in the show, so why don't we just go ahead and stop there. I Am Legend and Juno are both in theaters everywhere. Legend on 3,500-plus screens. Can't miss it. Juno is only on 40 or so. But if you get a chance to see either movie and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, Ellen Page and Diablo Cody discuss Juno and manage to destroy Adam's childhood with a feminist critique of one of his favorite 80s movies. Stay with us.
I should be royally ticked off at you. You know, I should be really cheesed off. I shouldn't want to talk to you anymore.
Well, because I got bored and had sex with you and I didn't want to, like, marry you?
Like I'd marry you. You'd be the meanest wife ever, okay? And I know that you weren't bored that day because there was a lot of stuff on TV and the Blair Witch Project was coming on Stars. And you were like, I haven't seen this since it came out, and so we should watch it. But oh, no, we should just make out instead. La, la, la.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That was a clip from Diablo Cody's Juno, easily the best script ever written by a former stripper, though I'm sure Nora Ephron fans would have something to say about that.
You are going to burn in hell.
But in any case, Adam, you did get a chance to catch up with Diablo and Ellen Page. Now, I can't imagine them being anything but amiable and fun people. Was that the case?
Absolutely. They were great to talk to, had a very enjoyable 15 or 20 minutes with them, though the interviewer right before me must have been really fun because I heard just bellows of laughter coming from the hotel room, and then I got in there and it was all serious. I don't know. I guess that's my fault, but it was a fun conversation, and I started by asking Diablo Cody how Juno originated. Did she have the story in mind or the character outlined first?
I think the character is autobiographical in a lot of ways, even though the story isn't necessarily autobiographical. Juno reminds me a lot of myself as a teenager, and so that, you know, obviously that factors in. The movie is kind of a junk drawer of memories from my life in a lot of ways. But I would say that the character probably did come first. And then I started picturing the character interacting with the adoptive parents, the Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman characters. And that image, the image of that kind of awkward dynamic and that interplay, that I built the movie around that.
Ellen, you said that you were in awe of Juno when you read the script. What specifically attracted you to her?
Well, I think she's just unbelievably refreshing. I mean, just completely devoid of stereotype and unique and witty, but extremely sincere and genuine. Just a really honest, whole character. And we don't see that a lot for young women in popular media. So I was just excited that she was going to be out in the world.
Diablo, you said that Ellen was Juno or is Juno. How so?
I don't know. Okay, Ellen I consider to be the soul of the movie. Obviously, Ellen is an incredible actor, and so she is acting. But I feel like there is a kinship between Ellen and Juno, and I feel that Ellen brought a lot of herself into the character and made the character richer in doing so.
Well, Ellen, speaking of being an incredible actor, your director and co-stars have made some lofty comparisons in some of the press notes and in the media, throwing out names like Audrey Hepburn and Meryl Streep. Do you read that? How do you react to it? And have there been actors or actresses that have had a specific big influence on you?
Well, that's always really intense when people do that. Like, it's really nice, but I just, you know, I do this because I love it, and I feel grateful every time I get to play a role that I feel passionate about, and, you know, I think the people I get to work with are amazing, and, you know, so it's always a hard thing to stomach when they say stuff like that. but it's very nice. And people I've looked up to, so many. I'm a huge Sissy Spacek fan, and Kate Winslet I love, and Laura Linney, and I mean, the list could go on.
Hard Candy was really a breakout role for you. And thinking about the two characters, did you draw any comparisons? Because Haley, like Juno, is very smart and appears to be very much in control. But the difference is that Haley really is in control and has all the answers. And Juno, with her, it's a little bit more of an act, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I don't really draw many comparisons. I think it's interesting because I play a lot of roles that by people are deemed like really strong female roles. And to me, I'm just playing, like, honest, whole young women. And if I was a guy, like, no one would be saying that to me, you know? If I was some up-and-coming male actor, they wouldn't go like, oh, wow, Emile Hirsch or Anton Yelchin, you play such strong young male roles. And it shows, like, how far we have to go in our image of young women in popular media, so that question isn't asked anymore, you know, because I feel like Juno is just one of the most honest characters I've played, and I get so annoyed that it's just, like, insulting when someone tells me I'm playing strong feminist roles. It's just, obviously, we have work to do.
Diablo, how did Jason Reitman get involved, and once the shooting started, were you still intimately involved in the process?
Yeah, Jason apparently was, you know, felt connected to the script early on, and he put aside something that he had written and was planning to direct in order to do Juno, which is something that I still think is just so cool and so amazing that, you know, Jason Reitman, you know, put one of his own projects aside for me. He came on, and I think he and I clicked instantly. We have a really similar sensibility despite having extremely different backgrounds. And he is such an incredible collaborator, one of the best there is, and so generous. And he not only treated the script with an incredible amount of respect, but he welcomed me onto the set. I was there most of the time, and that is rare for a writer. And I felt great camaraderie there, and I felt like I was really included. So I don't expect to have an experience like that anytime soon again.
One of the things I loved about the movie is the way it plays with our expectations in terms of the Jason Bateman and Jennifer Garner character, but also the parents.
Yeah.
Here we get these parents who we immediately think we know. We've kind of have them pegged from other movies, maybe the gruff blue-collar dad and the goofy mom who may be out of touch, but they really then get their redemptive moments and turn into the kind of parents we'd all like to have. How much were you trying to play with those conventions?
I absolutely was trying to play with those conventions. I think I set out to turn some conventions on their ear, so to speak. That was important to me. You know, I feel like there are a lot of formulaic movies out there, and while those movies have their place and are certainly enjoyable, I didn't want to write one.
Are you having boy trouble? Because I got to be honest, I don't really much approve of you dating in your condition. That's kind of messed up.
No, Dad, it's not.
I mean, that's pretty skanky. Isn't that what you girls call it? Skanky? Skeevy?
Please stop.
Tore up from the floor up?
That's not what it's about. I need to know that it's possible that two people can stay happy together forever.
Well, it's not easy, that's for sure.
Ellen, beyond the story and the character, Juno just has a lot of great lines. How much fun was it just to come on set every day and say that dialogue?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I first wrote the script, one of the things that I reacted to the most was just how awesome the dialogue was, and it felt really rhythmic and fluid and unique, but organic to me, you know, because I didn't speak exactly like Juno speaks when I was 16, but of course I had my own language with my friends, and so tackling that in the film was just about owning it and not forcing it, just being easy with it, yeah.
Did you add in any of your own stuff? Was there any improvisation, or was it the kind of thing where it was mainly page to screen?
Yeah, very, very rarely. I mean, this is all pretty much Diablo's magnificence. You know, I don't know, random words here and there, but...
Well, Diablo, Ellen touched on this a little bit, going back to the question about strong female characters, and I read in the Entertainment Weekly article, I believe, where you talked about the absence of these kind of characters, and these teenage girls maybe not getting as much credit as they should on screen, and you singled out Angela Chase from
yes.
My So-Called Life. Are there any other templates at all for the type of character Juno is?
It's difficult. You know, Ghost World springs to mind, actually.
Mm-hmm.
That's a movie I talk about a lot because it is there are so few films of that kind. And, you know, to have this have two female leads, and to have a film, you know, center around a female friendship, like Ghost World does, to me, that's super cool. And obviously, I do love My So-Called Life. But it's sad that I can only think of a couple examples. Mm-hmm. And it's sad that those, I think, would be the examples that other people would name as well. So it's a struggle. And I feel like I do have a responsibility now to write strong female roles.
Ellen, are there any examples that you come up with beyond what Diabolo has said?
Honestly, those are the ones that I usually say. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty frightening. Or, you know, they're in foreign films like Lucas Moodysson's Show Me Love or, you know, Heavenly Creatures. But then again, it's like a completely extreme, intense story, a beautiful film. So it's really unfortunate. Or someone was like, oh, but what about The Breakfast Club? And I was like, but Ally Sheedy gets all pretty in the end for the boy. I can't believe that this is like an iconic Breaking Barriers movie. I am sorry for all the lovers of The Breakfast Club. But when I first saw that, I was like traumatized.
Really?
The unique girl totally changes herself.
It's so strange that you brought that up, because I discussed that with somebody earlier today, actually. The whole Ally Sheedy thing at the end is deeply distressing. Mm-hmm. And for what? Emilio Estevez? You know?
But he's a wrestler.
Yeah.
You guys are messing with my childhood, though, here, of course.
I'm
That's
sorry.
One of those movies, you know, I saw in junior high.
I actually do
revered,
enjoy those movies.
Yeah.
I just, you know, maybe Breakfast Club, not feminist so much.
No, maybe not.
Yeah.
A little more problematic looking back on it. Diablo, you wrote a book, Candy Girl, autobiographical, and you've been a blogger and now screenplay. What are the differences in the forms? Do you enjoy writing one more than the other? Are you going to focus on screenplays, or do you think you're going to write another book?
Yeah, blogging is really just catharsis for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's a writing exercise that I do on a daily basis, and it keeps me connected to people at this point. Writing a book is actually very difficult because the page is all you have, and so it's you're on your own. And that actually can be quite difficult. The description is all up to you. Whereas when you make a film, there's a lot of people coming together. It's totally collaborative, and you have other people filling in the blanks for you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're all challenging in their own way. But I have to say, I think prose is still the most challenging.
Has the reaction to this film been a surprise at all? Obviously, you felt like you had to have written a decent script. And obviously, Ellen, you liked the script to be on board. But people have really taken to this film. I saw it in Toronto with a press audience, but 500 people there that laughed throughout the entire film, and then I heard the rapturous applause and ovation you got from the public audience. Has it been a surprise?
I think we all felt that we had made something special, but obviously you're going to be biased when you've had a wonderful experience. And the reception, the warmth of the reception has been surprising to me and overwhelming. It's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm grateful to even just be in the film in the first place, and shooting it really was a magnificent experience. And yeah, I thought we were coming together to make a pretty cool film. But yeah, the response has been just unbelievable, and I'm just really excited that a character like Juno is going to, you know, connect, hopefully, mm-hmm. to a lot of young people. That's pretty awesome.
I know you both have a lot of projects in the fire right now. What's next for you?
Well, hopefully I'll shoot a film this spring that I'm supposed to have shot for a while called Jack and Diane, mm-hmm. which is also with Olivia Thirlby, who plays Leah in Juno, and directed by a guy named Bradley Rescray, who's insanely talented. And just hopefully shooting like a short film in February, and then I have a film lined up for the summer. I have a film coming out in April, actually, called Smart People with Dennis Quaid and Sarah Jessica Parker and Thomas Hayden Church. So busy, but not, you know, just kind of like take my time right now because everything's a little crazy. Yeah.
Diablo, what about you?
I have a horror movie that I'm working on that's coming up, and called Jennifer's Body, and Jason Reitman is producing it. So he and I are going to be working together again, although not in the same capacity. And I'm really excited about that because horror is my favorite genre. And
really?
That's something I kind of touched on in Juno a little with her fondness for horror movies.
Sure.
And I also I have a series that I'm working on over at Showtime, a potential series called The United States of Tara that Toni Collette just signed on to be in, which is amazing. And I'm writing a kind of a college sex comedy. I'm keeping busy. Right now I'm obviously on strike. But, you know, up until that point, those are the things that I was working on.
This is the end of the year time. Obviously, a lot of the awards coming out, best films of the year, top 10 list kind of thing. I know you guys are both really busy. I don't know how many other movies you're seeing, but are there one or two movies that really stand out for you this year that you've seen that you think are the best, your favorites?
I absolutely love The Savages. I think that's a you know, the subject of sort of elder care and family relations, and not something that's really been touched on, and it's done in this really, you know, non-cloying, funny, interesting way.
Hmm. Ellen, what about you?
Well, I haven't seen The Savages. I'm really excited to see it because I'm a massive fan of both of those actors. I haven't seen a lot of movies, to be honest, but what I have really, really, really liked is Once. I absolutely loved Once, so clearly that probably won't have a chance at the... maybe I shouldn't say that. That sounds really rude, but you know what I mean.
It's a little film.
Perhaps at, the Oscars it might struggle.
It might.
But that is definitely a film that I really adored this year.
Yeah, I agree. I did too, and I think you're going to see it, though, on a lot of critics' lists of the
10
best.
Yeah, I hope so. They totally
surprised.
Deserve it, and I hope that didn't come across the wrong way, what
no.
I just said. You know what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, thank you both very much for your time. I absolutely loved the film, and I'm glad it's getting so much attention. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, that was Ellen Page and Diablo Cody. And I did want to mention real quick, there was a really interesting moment in the interview there where Ellen Page got a little bit defensive, it seemed, about the issue of her playing strong female characters like she does here in Juno and in the movie Hard Candy. And she makes a really great point about the fact that an interviewer probably wouldn't say to Emil Hirsch, for example, how do you feel about playing such strong male characters? We would just take that for granted. I do want to say, though, in my defense, I would actually take it for granted that any young actress would want to do the same thing and play strong female roles. And I was really more interested in asking her about the vulnerability of Juno's character, the fact that she comes off as so strong and all-knowing, but then we see some of that weakness come through, and I was just kind of trying to compare it to Hard Candy. Clearly, though, she's tired of getting asked that question, and I don't really blame her. So all in all, though, it was a really fun interview, and they were great.
Okay, time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater, and speaking of strong women, Adam, our top five lead actresses of 2007. Stay with us. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider in spoken word entertainment. Audible has over 35,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded and played back anywhere. Log on to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today. Again, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
Too bad about those two German couriers, wasn't it?
They got a lucky break. Yesterday there were just two German clerks. Today they're... they honor dead.
You are a very cynical person, Rickety.
If you forgive me for saying so. I forgive you.
Thank you. Will you have a drink with me, please?
No.
Oh, I forgot you never drink with anything. I'll have another, please.
Yes, monsieur.
You despise me, don't you?
Well, if I gave you any thought, I probably would.
But why? Oh, you object to the kind of business I do, huh?
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time now for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a beloved screenplay, and you, our beloved listeners, get a chance at winning a free DVD. Now, last week, we massacred Casablanca, a loose tie-in with our top five supporting performances of the year. I suggested that Peter Lorre's performance is one of my all-time favorite supporting actor performances, and of course, as one listener pointed out, I paid homage to Mr. Lorre by doing an impression of the Taco Bell Chihuahua.
Or Ren, of course, from Ren and Stimpy. Got a lot of references there from listeners, but we have to read this quick email from Eli Bard, New York City. The night that we recorded the show, we got home. Literally 30 minutes after I walked in the door from recording this show, I checked my email. There's an email from Eli answering last week's Massacre Theater, The Shawshank Redemption. He says, "Oh no, you didn't. This is about 3 weeks in a row of Remedial Massacre Theater. How lame do you have to be not to recognize Shawshank Redemption? What's next? Casablanca?"
I know.
That's a true story.
On the nose.
On the nose. He called it, and we felt really bad, but a lot of great entries, and it wasn't a record-setting entry, not even top five, actually, but close. There were a lot of entries. A lot of people noting your Peter Lorre performance. A lot of people wondering, where was my bogey performance? That was my bogey performance, people. I'm sorry. But this does also, before we get to the winner, Maddie, give me a chance for a little personal promotion. I get to mention the fact that, of course, Peter Lorre famously broke out for his performance in Fritz Lang's film M, and in the spring, a graphic novel adaptation of M is coming out, John J. Muth's graphic novel adaptation, with a foreword by Yours Truly. So if you're interested in M or graphic novels or both, maybe something you'll want to run out and get.
All right. Adam, reach into the film spotting hat and please pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Chris McCoy from Austin, Texas. Congratulations, Chris. Email feedback at filmspotting.net and we will set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Betty.
Yeah, Betty. Look, no, you don't rush it. I don't rush it. Okay? Now, we're going to play this nice and close, just like in the movies, okay?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it does tie in with our top five. The only specifics we'll give you, it ties in with the theme of lead male performances.
Yeah, well, Eli wanted harder. I think he's going to get it here.
Every time I say that, though, listeners write in and say how easy
it
is. But we will see this time. I agree with you. I think this one's going to be a little harder. And I started out, so you're going to give me the action.
And action.
I was working at this job, busting my butt for about a year and a half. They didn't give me a raise. My old lady, she leaves me because she says I'm a bum because I quit. Then after, I get this job working at the university, strictly for the experience. Guess what I was?
What?
What?
So what were you?
I was a subject.
A what?
A subject in the psych department. I was a subject for experiments. Reflexes, memory things. Except I didn't do anything when it got to electric shock. I did just once, but I just did that for the experience, so it don't count. Okay, that's 80.
Do it again?
Yeah, sure, I don't care.
Double or nothing? What? Is there an echo in here?
Hey, let's just do it, all right?
And scene. Really nicely done, Adam.
Thank you.
I honestly think some people are going to get it based solely on your performance.
Oh, I'm
that was
sure
pretty good.
Not. Well, we will see. If you know what film we just massacred, email your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net by Tuesday, December 18th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, please visit filmspotting.net.
Maddie, we need to get into our top five performances here by an actress we're going to start with, but we do want to get to our poll questions real quick, starting with the results from last week. We wanted to know from you what your most anticipated holiday film is, holiday being, of course, thinking about December movies. So we gave you some choices here: Atonement, Charlie Wilson's War, Juno, Sweeney Todd, There Will Be Blood, or Youth Without Youth, the Francis Coppola film. How did it come out, Maddie?
Oh, we had a lot of votes. Number one, There Will Be Blood at 33%, close behind Juno at 30%, Sweeney Todd third at 18%, Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story, coming in at 7%, tied with Atonement at 7%, Charlie Wilson's War 4%, and Youth Without Youth, only 5 votes, coming in at 1%.
Yeah, not a surprise at all for me to see the Paul Thomas Anderson film There Will Be Blood at number 1. Juno number 2. Sweeney Todd, a lot of love for that, which we did see last week. I am disappointed with Atonement, only 7%. It's just crushing me that more people aren't getting behind this film. I do want to note, it's going to come up maybe later in the next segment, but I want to note that last week I misspoke and I suggested that we had both seen all of these films except for Sweeney Todd and Walk Hard. You actually have not yet seen There Will Be Blood.
Right.
And I have. So that's why Daniel Day-Lewis will not certainly be on your top five actors list. We'll see if he makes my
list. Maybe I'll just give it to him. I mean, you know he's going to do a great
job. Some of our listeners have already done that. They're like, he's my number one performance of the year. Jose, El Deuterino in Portugal. He's like, give it to him. I haven't seen it, but give it to him. Fair enough. He deserves that kind of recognition, I guess. This week's question on filmspotting.net, we gave you our best supporting actors and actresses last week, and so we want to know, from our selections, who would you give your vote for best supporting actor of 2007 to?
Would it be Hal Holbrook, Javier Bardem, Toby Kebbell, Irfan Khan, Kurt Russell, or J.K. Simmons?
Of course, Irfan Khan from the namesake Toby Kebbell, one of your picks, a great pick there from the movie Control. Hal Holbrook from Into the Wild, Javier Bardem, our number one from No Country for Old Men, Kurt Russell in Death Proof, and J.K. Simmons for Juno. Let us know what you think. Go to filmspotting.net and tell us who the best supporting actor of 07 was. Let's go ahead then and get to our lead performances now, Maddie, and we're going to start with the ladies. Who was your number five female performance of the year?
My number five was Nikki Blonsky for Tracy Turnblad in Hairspray.
Really?
Yeah, you can tell. She must have grown up idolizing the original Hairspray because she absolutely nails this role. It's like she was born to play it. In a film with luminaries like Walken and Travolta, she more than holds her own. She's an electric presence, and I think the opening number, Good Morning Baltimore, is actually my favorite opening of any film this year, and it's because she's just so much fun to watch.
Good morning, Baltimore. Every day's like an opera.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. She didn't make my list, but I loved her performance. I loved the beginning. I remember when we talked about Hairspray briefly on the show back in the summer, I said the same thing about Good Morning Baltimore. It's a fantastic sequence. I was smiling and having fun with that film like maybe no other summer film that I had seen. It did kind of wane for me a little bit, but I loved the beginning, and that's a great choice. Nikki Blonsky is really good.
All right, what's your number five?
Well, my number five, I do want to make one quick note, one performance that neither of us will mention. That's Marianne Cotillard in La Vie en Rose in the Edith Piaf biopic. She's getting a lot of attention from various critics groups, probably going to get an Oscar nomination.
We just haven't seen
it. We haven't seen the film yet. I also haven't seen Carice Van Houten in Black Book, the Paul Verhoeven film, and she is also getting some attention for Best Actress from some various critics groups. Maddie, you have seen it, but don't really want to comment on the worth of that film.
No comment.
Okay, well, my number five is Christina Ricci from Black Snake Moan, and it's one of those performances that gets called raw, as we like to joke about, Maddie, because it's sexually charged, and she shows herself in various states of emotional and physical duress or undress. But hey, sometimes I like a good raw performance, especially one that gets all the non-raw moments right as well. I just think Ricci's a really genuine actress and really believable and honest, despite the fact that she plays a lot of characters. Mm-hmm. I think she works, and I think she works great in Black Snake Moan.
No, I think she's actually great in that film, and I like the audacity of that film, but overall, the project just didn't work for me, so she can't make my list.
Okay.
All right, well, my number four, and I am just going to slaughter this name, but I'm going to give it my best. Sidse Babett Knudsen as Helena in After the Wedding.
After the Wedding.
Yeah. I'll talk more about this movie on our next show, undoubtedly, but this movie features the highest stakes for its characters of any film this year. It's like an Ibsen play on film, and it's because of performances like Knudsen's that make it riveting rather than melodramatic. There's just something so familiar and familial about her performance. She is asked to endure so much in this movie, and it's like watching this happen to a neighbor or someone you're really close to, and it makes it all the more gut-wrenching.
One I definitely need to see and will check out soon. I have it at home right now. My number four is the legend Julie Christie for the Sarah Polley film Away From Her. Not a whole lot that I really need to say about Julie Christie. How do you get more elegant than Julie Christie? Not a showy performance, that one that really, I think, runs the gamut of emotions as a woman struggling not only with Alzheimer's, but whether or not she really wants to be with her husband anymore. It's a pretty heavy film, and again, not a showy performance, but a really graceful one.
Yeah, Julie Christie is actually my number three, and watching someone slip away to Alzheimer's is crippling in itself. Watching it happen to the beautiful Julie Christie is even more devastating because she has such a joie de vivre, and you're absolutely right. There's nothing showy about this performance, but we get all the information we need in a faraway look or just an extended random pause. Just really elegantly done.
Yeah, the moments of silence between Julie Christie and Gordon Pinsent say volumes. Great choice, obviously, there for you, Maddie. My number three, let's hear a quick clip.
Well, what do you want?
I want to see you again. I want to talk to you somewhere outside of here. Maybe we could have a coffee or something.
I can't have coffee. It's on the bad food list you gave me. What kind of doctor are you?
Well, you don't have to have coffee. You could have water or fruit juice.
That's a bad idea. I'm married. You're married. I'm pregnant. You're my doctor.
You're right. It's crazy. It's unethical on my part.
I have a very jealous husband. He'd kill you if he ever saw us. He don't like another man even look at me.
Is he large?
He's large enough, and he drives right past here on the way to work.
Maybe we shouldn't be standing in the street then.
We're getting into the territory here, Maddie, where all three of my next choices really carry the films they're in. There are, of course, some great supporting players, but they are almost in every scene of the film, and that's Carrie Russell from Adrienne Shelley's great little comedy, Waitress. She has fantastic timing and chemistry with Nathan Fillion there as the doctor that she ends up having an affair with, but I just think Carrie Russell is luminous in this film and is just a lot of fun to watch on screen. One of the best comedic performances of the year. My second favorite comedic performance by a female this year.
All right, well, my number two is Tong Wei from Lust Caution. Absolutely the most sultry and sexy performance of the year. She is absolutely ferocious in this film, and she has to be if she's going to pull off her mission as an undercover Chinese agent trying to assassinate a Japanese capitulator. The relationship that develops is an amalgam of things. It's tempestuous, of course. It's feral, and I think she's just brilliant.
She's amazing, and we were both mixed on this film that we saw in Toronto, Ang Lee's film, but Tong Wei is my number two, and if we're saying the name wrong, someone please correct us. We are not sure how to say it, but She's my number one breakout performance of the year in terms of a new performer on the scene, even ahead of Sam Riley from Control, who I love. But she's just mesmerizing with this transition she has to make from this young, naive actress to the disillusioned double agent. And certainly with the explicit sex scenes and the NC-17 rating, this makes Ricci's raw performance I mentioned in Black Snake Moan look like Julie Andrews and Mary Poppins. But she really is just brilliant and keeps us intrigued and invested in the story, even as it spins a little out of control, I think.
Yeah, she's absolutely fantastic, as we like to say here on the show. All right, well, my number one is, no surprise, Ellen Page in Juno. It really is a performance of the ages. I can't imagine anyone else pulling it off. She is a delight.
Yeah, I actually even made the same note. Ellen Page is my number one, and I will admit that it was a tough battle with Page and Tong Wei, because for right or wrong, it's tempting to go with the actress who had to do more heavy lifting, and I think it's fair to say that Tong Wei does in Lust Caution, but I can't imagine anybody else playing Juno. She captures all of those contradictions, her maturity and innocence and the toughness and vulnerability, and she delivers all those really snappy lines of dialogue without playing up the irony or letting things devolve too much into quirk, like we said about the film as a whole. So I think it's the best comedic performance of the year, certainly, and one of the best of the year, period. I'm really surprised, Maddie, that we had as much overlap as we did. I guess maybe we're on to something with these choices.
Well, you know what they say about great minds.
Yes.
Okay, time for one last quick break. Up next, some really hot guy-on-guy action as we list our favorite male performances of 2007. Stay with us.
Let's take a look at what is new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. A great week for DVD releases. I think I want to start with actually the film Once coming out. It includes musical commentary and a film commentary with the director John Carney and the musicians and actors in the film, Glenn Hansard and Markita Orglova. Once is definitely one to check out. Also, the Blade Runner DVD, the 5-disc Ultimate Collector's Edition set is out. I think that was on your top 5 DVDs of the year.
Yeah, my number 4 and on my Christmas list.
Yes, it is on your Christmas list. I'll remember that, Maddie. It was also in my list of the top 5 box sets I want for Christmas. The Simpsons movie is out, a movie I thought was very funny from earlier this year. Also, Stardust, a film that I enjoyed with Michelle Pfeiffer, Claire Danes in that film, Robert De Niro, director Matthew Vaughn, a guest here on Film Spotting, and also Braveheart, the special collector's edition is out, and a 3-disc ultimate edition of Evil Dead. So if you haven't finished your holiday list yet, you can now put it together. A good week for DVDs, Maddie.
All right, moving on to donations. And last week, Adam, you so subtly call out for donations to help fund our trip to Sundance. And, of course, our wonderful listeners responded in spades.
Yes, they did. Very generous last week. We really do appreciate it.
It is rather overwhelming. All right, well, on to your Sam Van Hallgren patented film spotting nicknames. Josh, Satellite Vertigo, a.k.a. Noel Country for Old Elves. Spencer, Murder Incorporated. Mark Mondo Mondo, Michelle Insidious Husbandry, Christopher Serious Tongue Lashing, Michael Travis Skip Daughter, Jeff Hair Club for Mammals, that's a Silver Club member, Sam The Silent Sea is for Killer, Keith Count This, Jason Spanking the Money, Terry TJ Hookset MA, Eric Saint of the Backlot, aka Magnum Down Under, and Booples.com, it rhymes with Zooples.
I don't know what Sam is smoking. God, TJ
he
hooks
got in
it
the eggnog
MA?
Early. I don't
He's
know what that
it
means.
In Massachusetts?
I have no idea.
I have no idea either. But again, we really do appreciate your generosity with your donations this week to Film Spotting. Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
Kate!
What are you doing?
Kate! Are you all right?
She wanted him to know. She has the right.
Of course she has.
For sake.
When you're ready, come inside. Everybody's all right.
She's pregnant.
Now you know what's at stake.
You are listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and that was a scene from last year's film, Children of Men, and we wanted to play a clip from it there because we did end up talking about great tracking shots in our discussion of Atonement. It was kind of just an off-the-cuff thing. I mentioned the scene from Scorsese's Goodfellas and Touch of Evil and The Player, and of course several people wrote in to say, how could you forget Children of Men? Several great Alfonso Cuarón tracking shots in that film. You're absolutely right. We didn't really forget him. We didn't really plan on getting off on that tangent, but actually that topic will be a great top five topic someday, our top five tracking shots. And of course, a lot of filmmakers in addition to those that use tracking shots and long takes in interesting ways. And like I said, it will be a good topic for an upcoming show. But this show is all about our favorite performances of the year, Maddie. We're now on to our favorite actors, and my number five is Julie Christie's counterpart in Away From Her. It's Gordon Pinsent. He plays a former professor who's coming to terms with his wife's Alzheimer's and really has to confront his past transgressions as a husband. So understated and seemingly aloof that it's easy to see how he could be selfish and impossible to live with, and yet how you could be drawn to him at the same time. And the subtle nature of the performance, I think, just makes the emotional moments that much more powerful because you realize what it takes for him to break down. And I think you're going to see this theme throughout all my performances here. Subtlety, understatement. Yeah. Those are my favorite performances of the year, and he's right there.
Okay. Well, my number five, I have to say, I don't have a number five. I was so won over by four performances this year, and so I kept scratching out these names in the number five slot, but they just didn't belong with my one through four.
Okay.
So in my number five, I just want to give some honorable mention to the people that I considered. Pierce Brosnan in Seraphim Falls, Johnny Depp in Sweeney Todd, Adrian Brody in Darjeeling Limited, Chris Cooper in Breach, Viggo in Eastern Promises, and Simon Pegg in Hot Fuzz. Those are all my honorable mention.
Okay.
But my number four, Ulrich Muir in The Lives of Others. He really has this daunting task of playing a dutiful bureaucrat so well. He's so convincing that it's terrifying. He's the embodiment of this sort of Orwellian nightmare to the point that it's almost impossible to believe that he could ever change. But of course, he does manage to pull it off. And the great tragedy is, of course, we lost Mr. Muir in July.
Yeah, we did. And of course, if you're thinking, wait a second, that film won an Oscar last year, how can it really be eligible for things this year? The fact is, it can be eligible, just not in the foreign language film category. It's a funky Academy thing. And also, the film did really screen for most U.S. audiences after the first of the year. I think we reviewed it on Film Spotting in February or something, but it is a fantastic performance. And you talk about understatement and subtlety. I mean, it's the pinnacle of it. I really should have considered him here. I think maybe I didn't because I do still see it as a last year film, and that's just probably wrong. But I also want to mention about your honorable mentions. I haven't seen Pierce Brosnan in Seraphim Falls, but all the other ones you mentioned, all were guys I considered, maybe not for the top five, but they were up there. I liked all those performances, so some great picks there by you. My number four, I'm giving it to Josh Brolin in No Country for Old Men, a recent guest here on Film Spotting, a very physical performance, one that doesn't rely on a lot of dialogue. I can't remember if you told this story in our interview or somewhere else I saw it, but he mentioned how working with the Coen brothers, they don't give you a lot of feedback as an actor, and the grunt he gives when he finds the suitcase, that was something they rehearsed over and over, and finally they just were like, okay, I guess that's good enough, and that's about all they gave him. But they rehearsed that grunt, those little noises, those little subtle movements. They were very calculated, and I think that Josh Brolin is great in those physical moments and also gives a really complex performance in that he has to have this badass side of Llewellyn Moss. We have to see him as this Vietnam vet who can take care of himself and isn't afraid of the Grim Reaper, Javier Bardem. But there is also this sweet side. He has to be believable as a guy who is being really stupid by hanging on to this money, but he's doing it for his wife more than anything else, to give her a better life. We have to believe that side of him as well, and we do.
All right, it's a great pick. Well, my number three is Mr. Richard Gere in The Hoax. I mean, it has to be so hard as an actor to play a character who has to believe pathologically in something that isn't true. You're playing a role of someone playing a role, and Gere really captures the confidence of this con man even as his world falls apart around him, and we have a lot of fun, of course, watching him get out of these corners. But Gere's at his best in capturing the toll the charade is taking on this author. The moments when he's channeling Hughes are so unsettling because we don't know if this great con man is losing to his own con.
Yeah, exactly. It really is a great performance in that film about the guy Clifford Irving, who wrote the Howard Hughes autobiography, managed to con the whole world. It's really an amazing story, and he is fantastic in it. My number three goes to Tim Roth from the Francis Ford Coppola movie Youth Without Youth, which I think we'll actually be discussing a little bit on next week's show. He plays a 70-year-old Romanian intellectual who's struck by lightning and severely injured, but not only does he survive and heal, but he actually gets younger in the recovery process and also acquires some really special abilities when it comes to gaining knowledge. At a minimum, Maddie, it's a dual performance. He plays multiple roles here, and there may even be other doppelgangers who appear. I'm not 100% comfortable saying for sure at this point how many Tim Roths there are, but I think the way he differentiates the two personas is distinct, but not this Jekyll and Hyde type of scenario. And it's a movie that would drift completely out into the ether if not for Tim Roth's performance there to ground it and to give us something tangible to hang on to and to care about.
Yeah, great pick. My number two is, I'm going to butcher this name again, Rolf Losgaard as Jorgen in After the Wedding. Now, I know he's getting a lot of love as a supporting actor, and I don't really understand that. This is ostensibly the story of three people. They all get equal screen time. Their actions all have equal consequences on each other. Mads Mikkelsen, who plays the other male lead, the ex-lover of Jorgen's wife, is, of course, better looking and certainly comes across as more of the matinee idol. But his storyline is no more important, and it's Losgaard's Jorgen that really drives this movie.
Well, obviously, I am pledging now to see
you
After the Wedding.
It.
It's
you
out now on DVD,
it.
And I pledge to see it before next week's show when we get to our top 10 films of the year. My number two is the one big kind of showy performance in this group of understated actors, and that's Samuel L. Jackson in Black Snake Moan. Not to say that Sam Jackson can't be subtle, because he is, even in this film, but it is the bigger performance, I think. He gets to have some fun as this old blues musician trying to redeem the out-of-control sex star of Christina Ricci, and there's a few of those wild-eyed, self-righteous moments where he gets to preach a little bit and kind of be Sam Jackson, but this is the first real Samuel L. Jackson performance I think we've seen in a long time where I didn't feel like he was just riffing on his persona like in Snakes on a Plane, and he nails all the performance scenes, which I do think is a big part of the success of this film. He maybe looks a little bit awkward with the guitar, but the fact is you can tell that it's him singing and him playing, and he sells all of those scenes. I really do think it's a great Samuel L. Jackson performance, finally playing a character and not just himself. If you see my
had a lot of love for Black Snake Moan.
I did, though we'll see if it maybe got bumped out of my top 10 next week.
All right.
Okay.
Well, my number one, you've already mentioned him. It's Mr. Gordon Pinsent in Away From Her. I have to admit, I wasn't familiar with his work at all before this movie, but his performance just blew me away. You already touched on it. Like Julie Christie, the strength of this performance is in its simplicity. He's not necessarily a likable guy, but we watch his life partner. We know he took her for granted at times. We watch her slip away, watch him wrestle with that line between selfishness and selflessness, not knowing where he's going to go. And again, he doesn't go big. He never raises his voice
No.
in this film at all, but we can see the tempest of emotion that just sort of seethes underneath his skin.
It's all there underneath the surface. You're absolutely right. And I want to say the thing about most of these choices, and this is true of any of these end-of-the-year awards we're doing probably, is that in many cases, Gordon Pinsent was my number five. He could have been my number
Yeah.
one. And I've actually reworked my list a little bit from what I had on my Chicago Film Critics Award ballot. I had these five nominees, but in a little bit different order because it's just so hard to decide. I think they're all great performances. Gordon Pinsent certainly was brilliant this year in Away From Her, which brings us to my number one, Maddie. Let's go ahead and hear a clip.
We went through some troubled times. Yes. What does that tell you about my work?
That life betrayed you. And you went into hiding, and you took your characters with you. So they began guarding their lives. They stopped giving in to temptation.
No, Miss Wolf. They learned the cost of living only for themselves. And I became aware of problems far greater than my own. And you insult my writing by trying to define it by a single unhappy event from my past. If I had known you were going to subject my work to such simplistic psychological criticism, I never would have wasted my time with you in the first place.
And that's a scene with an actor who has been very good on stage and screen for a long time, but I think this may actually end up being his signature role. That's Frank Langella in Starting Out in the Evening. He plays Leonard Schiller, a reasonably well-known writer who is still trying to turn out a book, even though he's getting old and his health is waning, and a young master student played by Lauren Ambrose, who was on my list of best supporting actresses last week, she comes after him to write her master's thesis about his work and kind of put him back into the literary limelight again. And it's just an intense, internalized performance, a lot like Pinsent, a lot like Brolin, very mannered but not tidy or stiff, just perfectly precise. He really nails it. Have you had a chance to see it yet?
Yeah, and he's absolutely fantastic in it. And actually, I got a chance to watch that at the same time or right after watching The Bucket List with our friend Jack Nicholson.
And Morgan Freeman.
And the contrast between Jack Nicholson's performance
and Langella.
Wow, night and day.
Yeah, I'm guessing so. Well, starting out in the evening, open in New York and L.A., I think near the end of November. It actually opens in Chicago this weekend, and it's worth checking out if it doesn't come to a theater near you on DVD when it becomes available. A really good film directed by Andrew Wagner, his second movie.
All right. Well, those are our top five lead performances of 2007. Send your picks or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also discuss our picks over at our Spout group, filmspotting.spout.com.
Opening wide this weekend, Alvin and the Chipmunks, The Perfect Holiday, and I Am Legend, which we are saying, despite
yeah,
the fact
good,
that it
it's a good time.
Goes downhill a little bit, definitely worth checking out. In limited release, Juno, a movie we tell you to see as fast as you can. The Kite Runner, a movie we both need to see, and Youth Without Youth. Atonement is expanding to more screens. Maddie says that it is worth seeing. I say go to that one as fast as you can as well. Also, a quick note on the movie Grace is Gone, which I saw at Sundance way back and also at the Chicago International Film Festival. That movie with John Cusack is out now and expanding to more screens. And our interview with John Cusack, part of a roundtable I participated in, you can actually click on that and read the transcript of that interview by going to filmspotting.net and just look for the badge on the top right of the site.
On next week's show, reviews of Charlie Wilson's War and Sweeney Todd, the Demon Barber of Fleet Street. And special guest Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune joins us for our countdown of the top 10 films of 2007.
Thanks to Alex and Angela in our message boards, Frank Huckle and Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Exit Clove and Livewire Recordings for this week's music. Learn more at livewirerecordings.net. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Maddie Robinson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.